Welcome to Home Run with Hampton Dwight on Eagle FM and Drive Time Show. We are here until the hour of 6 as always. And yet, and also, don't forget, we are always here, you know, every time we're here, we always meet one condition, or more like, one requirement. That's to come with an exciting topic.
100%.
Oh, yeah. Ian, 100%. That's a mistake. Now, we have another topic today. Today's topic is one regarding, it's one about, actually my all time favorite and everyone else that likes food in the same way that I do. And that is, today's topic, is about, food, not really food. And that's, that's a very, broad way of putting it. AKA, how to produce it. And, that's, with regards to, fertilizer. We, for those, anyone that, remembers their, primary school or secondary school agriculture, they, know that they learned that, everything else, needs to eat. And plants are also a living organism that also needs to food to eat. That means they need food for them to feed us. One thing I find funny about our symbiotic relationship with plants, Dwight.
Mm-hmm.
Someone once asked on social media is that, we humans, more often, tap ourselves on the shoulder and start, giving ourselves a lot of credit that we farm plants for us to eat once they are ripe. What if it's the other way around? What if plants are farming us so that, when we die, they also, eat us because
Have you ever walked past a cemetery, Amut?
Oh, Dwight, I didn't want it to be that dark.
No, but it is reality.
All the time.
Every time, Amut.
Uh-huh.
Do you know that there was a theory? It was an article that I read on the Guardian online. It was in one of their sections based upon science and something else.
Yeah.
Where the researchers that the article was citing,
mm-hmm,
were looking at the notion of, are we potentially giving or are we potentially not contributing as much back to soil fertility as we are supposed to? So I'm talking about animal and human waste.
Yeah.
Which is obviously one of the first ways in terms of providing for the nutrients back into the soil. Then you've got obviously dead animal and plant material, which is obviously deceased animals, deceased persons, deceased plants and animals, that work back into the soil.
Yeah.
Which actually reinforces that old thing that you always hear at burials. Ashes to ashes, dust to
dust.
Oh,
yeah.
And that dust to dust, they literally hits where it's not supposed to hit, but it hits you there. Because it throws you into that philosophic, waterfall.
What is life? Type of
where they keep asking, what is the meaning of life? And those kinds of questions. Yeah. And that particular, if you work from that thing, you go like, yes, there is a cycle. The cycle exists. So.
Yeah, look, if you just look at it from more like a not astrological, but astronomical standpoint, everything.
Mm.
If not, let me just say, almost if not everything, in the universe moves in cycles.
Mm.
The sun rotates on, the sun rotates, the earth rotates around the sun and it rotates around its axis. So does the moon. And you basically have everything moving, moving in cycles. And, documentary, one lady almost ruined the water for me. It's just that I need it to survive.
Yeah.
When she pointed out that every drop of water that you are drinking is not something new that's coming from some heavenly, space somewhere.
Yeah.
Sorry, holy water guys. But the point is, anyone that...
which is true.
look, there's something called a water cycle. That means the water that we have today have been in existence for as long as this planet have been alive. Dinosaurs drank the same water. They pooped or peed it out and then it evaporated, formed the overall water cycle. Everything keeps going back into the cycle, and then the water condenses and then it rains and then it flows. And guess what? The sun shines, it evaporates, condensation. This has been going on for millennia. Yeah, so.
Millions of years.
Yeah. No, literally.
Literally, yeah.
Millions and millions of years.
Yeah.
That's been going on. So,
I know, we went off on a tangent.
Tangent, I mean, yeah. Look, the point is that to toss the, you know, but the holy water out through the window.
Look, it's you and the holy water people's name.
Sorry. Look, the point.
Any person can go call a river holy and then Amur is in trouble.
Oh, yeah. So, today's subject though is not about the basic, or more like the rudimentaries of how planet Earth operates. It's about, you know, I think I completely agree with you and that lady or the, you know, the gentleman or the guys that did that research. Because, well, I think we are being selfish when we propose things like, you know, things like cremation, for example.
No, but it's most obviously based upon the religion. Because
if
you're Hindu,
the earth fed you, feed it back, dude.
Yeah, but if you are Hindu, there's a belief that your remains must be burnt up.
Mm.
And if you're obviously Christian, then, you know, throw him in a ditch somewhere.
So technically speaking, Christian is very environmentally friendly. But,
but in a more concentrated, restricted manner.
So, today's.
We don't want any Walking Dead scenarios.
No,
zombie apocalypse.
Yeah. No, when we say that, you know, recycle, we are not talking about Jeffrey Dahmer. That's not what we mean.
You went very far.
No, I don't want people thinking outside the wrong box. Today's discussion involves the subject of fertilizer, specifically organic fertilizer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which also I think ties into our environmental protection or climate change mitigation strategy methods for how do we make sure that we solve the problem at its core. Well, boy, that's a heavy one.
But it's not just that, Helmut, because here's the thing. Okay, you are good. You are right.
Thanks.
On the part. Okay, I don't know about the good part. But don't worry.
I know. I'm going to take it anyway.
Starting from the organic inputs.
Yeah.
You obviously want to produce, because if you've seen our poster, dear listeners, it's also a notion in terms of how does an organic producer reach the market discussion. The inputs obviously have to justify that the thing at the end is organic. Okay, you can't obviously allow your cattle to be chewing on a piece of plastic bag because said particular organic
digestive issues
would be thrown out of the window.
Yeah.
And obviously you'd be seeing, you know, cow dung infused with laces or, you know, a folded plastic bag. And have you ever seen that scenario?
I've witnessed that. And I think anyone that, a lot of people that practice, subsistence farming in terms of animal husbandry in the Kavango regions have come across that. I've basically witnessed cattle being slaughtered because they had these, terrible digestive issues. And
because the
land is so barren, they are basically improvising on what not to eat, which is a bad idea.
Mm.
Yeah. So every time that something that is undigestible, like plastics, for example, is swallowed, there is nothing your digestive system can do with it. I mean, Mother Earth herself is looking at that thing going like, what am I supposed to do with that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it causes a whole lot of, of digestive problems to the point where it's not a good thing for the farmer or for the cow.
It never has been. Mm. Now, obviously, much of the particular conversation stems from a conference that I attended. We obviously listened to the particular, audio in preparation for today's particular show, dear listeners, so that if you know in terms of what the context is about.
Yeah.
At the heart of it is about reaching a market or a consumer. They had 4 different versions, specifically at this conference, about talking about how to reach a market. One of them was the most interesting one that I ever listened to. The particular lady in Maltahia, who around the town of Maltahia, if you've never been to the south of Namibia, and specifically that town of Maltahia.
How is it pronounced?
Maltahia. So if you read the name and you don't see the German umlaut on the O,
yeah,
which is many people read Maltahohe,
Oh, no, that's better. Mine is worse.
The name is Malta here. So you flow over the last part.
It's here.
Here. Like saying here, but you literally have to contort your mouth. Here. Malta here. So, the town Malta here.
That would have gotten me into a lot of current problems. but go on.
That's you and Granel. Around Malta here is a whole bunch of lodges. The scenario is Malta here sits in a unique position that it's positioned within a tourist zone where a high amount of tourists come to. The second scenario was obviously the gentleman that went and decided in my other adopted region, Kavango West, there with the watermelon produce is, you know, king of.
You know, we are making plans of juicing the heck out of it.
To get to the juice level of things.
Yeah.
And then there was obviously the other particular engagement of the online platform for organic products. And then the second one was obviously the particular, the market that you and I already spoke about markets, you know, community markets.
Yeah.
In terms of that they are aspect in terms of to help the everyday buyer who probably doesn't have enough money to walk into a retail shop or to travel that far to get to a retail shop because retail shops are positioned in specific zones. Zones that are technically they reflect the community. Please don't ask me why I say that, Hamoud. Why do I say that?
Uh-huh.
Well, if you look at malls, since Independence Avenue is technically dying away because you don't find those same shops in Independence Avenue except for the shop right at the end of the street.
Yep.
Nah, of Independence. Okay, it's technically also not at the end of the street because it's literally close to the junction of John Maynard. So yep. It's close to there. It's the only particular identifiable retail outlet that knows it's been there for the past 40 years, because I know about that outlet since I was on kindergarten.
Yeah.
My mom used to work in old Home Affairs, which was opposite it. And I was at kindergarten at the convent, you know, behind it.
Oh,
I would just walk out from there and just walk straight to my mom. Obviously got beaten up in between because my mom was asking.
That's so close. How did you?
Yeah, well, back then in the 80s, what, that was 1989 or 1990. If you think about it, you know, it's not particularly safe because that time there were people that were also kidnapping kids. So it was a little bit of a scare.
Thank you for surviving it.
No, there was a lot of people that obviously, you know, kidnapped kids in South Africa and then come to Namibia to try and run away from the authorities there. And then they would just drive to Namibia. Anyway.
Jeez.
Besides the quick history chat there. Now, the subject matter speaks predominantly about the market, gaining access to a market. The retail outlets have realized, you know, condense yourselves in a format known as a mall, where it attracts, the mall already attracts the customers. So to improve on the possibility that you will have customers to your shop, you position yourself in a mall. Yeah, the rent might be high, but you position yourself in a mall to sort of like eliminate that rent threat with the opportunity of getting a lot of feet and a lot of potential customers buying from you. Hence why the malls are technically now the newest forms of resembling commerce and economic activity. Now, here's the downside, Helmut. You can't go to a mall with your fresh produce and put up a stall in the middle of the mall to give more variety. In one sense, it can be pulled off. In another sense, it'll be a major question because then you've got a lot of large retailers that will say to the mall managers, hey, listen, Dwight and his watermelon produce from Kavango West, what are they doing here? And since the retailers are both carrying, or all of them will be carrying watermelons as well as part of their stock, They'll be saying, yeah, but he's there to literally undercut us on our prices.
Okay, now I'm confused.
In the market, Hamoud, it's always interesting to see. People in the private sector snitch on each other. Like, if you want a competitive edge, they snitch. They literally snitch.
So they basically do the same thing that political parties do to each other, except low-key.
Yeah, low-key. Drop a, you know, small call there to...
And all that, and all that, so they, so the snitcher can gain competitive advantage on the other?
And it's more like to penalize the other party, the party that was snitched on. So why do I say that? For example, I've seen it many times. Anyway, yeah, sometimes it's a food inspector being called to a place selling food. Or it's city police to a club, and you would have seen that a lot. Or city police to a bar, because city police comes and checks whether or not you've
got... At a very convenient time that someone dropped a bottle in a certain aisle.
Not just a bottle. Let's, for example, say what's the thing's name? You've got a very successful bar outlet running somewhere here in the formal part of Windhoek, this Windhoek East side. And the person you're renting from, the landowner, says, okay, last month's rent was 20,000. The next upcoming month's rent will be now pushed to 30,000. Now, obviously, you as the business owner, you'll be going like, what's with the sudden move?
Yeah.
Now, what many people don't know is that there is a level of conservatism under some of the property owners in Namibia. And you'll find it also in Swakop. That's the only other town I know that has the same particular influence in terms of what kinds of businesses you can open. Many cases, the landowner that is seeking a tenant is against the idea of a club or a bar. But a club and a bar is like one of the easiest and quickest ways for you, the person with the business idea, to make money in Namibia. Yeah. You can make money, Helmut.
And also one of the quickest way to launder money.
That too. You know, and one of the quickest ways also to get involved with other particular nefarious activities, for example, like narcotics dealership and stuff like that. I know. And nightclubs have lots of negative, components that associate around it.
Mm-hmm.
However, it is a very quick, if you want a get-rich-quick scheme, that is a get-rich-quick scheme. Invite a whole bunch of people, market an event for people to come dance, sing and dance, charge money, get the money, pay the people that worked for you on the project, and voila, you sit with all the proceeds afterwards. However, many people are doing this particular business model for longevity, not for, you know...
instant porridge.
Let's use just instant porridge. They're not in it for like an instant porridge thing.
Yeah.
So then your tenant decides, and I've known one or two business people who encountered this particular scenario.
Oh, dear.
Last month, rent was 20,000. They see, wow. Every weekend, Helmut's bar is just packed to the rafters. People are spending their whole salaries.
Landlord is doing the math.
Landlord is going like, oh, ho. The child are all. Monies are rolling. And then, obviously, it leads into the next thing. And then, obviously, disputes happen. And then someone incidentally, anonymously. Unanimously. Anonymously calls city police. City police shows up on a weird day when it's your fullest time of the month.
Yeah.
And they ask, where is your liquor license? And if your liquor license doesn't say you are you can be open
until
2 or until 4, then it's like city police telling you, the owner, please tell your people to go sleep. And then your liquor license can be revoked right there on the spot. So that makes the situation a little bit weird.
Jeez.
Like I illustrated it now.
Yeah.
Now I know I went off topic with the sort of like the snitching discussion.
Yeah, backstabbing.
Not a backstabbing. So most of the cases, you know, they know who snitched on who.
Oh, dear.
And then they still smile in each other's faces. Don't worry. It's what business It's what business people do.
But normalizing it is terrible, are you?
So getting back to the organic discussion of things.
Yeah.
Now,
market access.
Many of the particular stories were based upon starting something from new. The lady in Malta here, she's now literally in reverse helping the local community in Malta here. Because in many cases, the shop that they had there, they got their fresh produce from Windhoek. Let me say it again. The shop there was supplied with fresh produce from Windhoek. So we get a glimpse, Helmut, through a problematic setting of supply. Meaning, people must be empowered to do the thing themselves on the ground so that they have their own supply. Another one was the guy in Kavango West. The guy that literally, he's now the template after I recorded now, obviously everything. He's now the template of agroforestry. Literally.
How's he pulling that off?
Well, he explained it that he literally had to use a former Mahangu field or that would, meaning soil of, yeah. of an abandoned Mahangu field,
yeah.
that was depleted from nutrients. Remember the Skavango West? It's yeah. the Inkurinkurus region.
Yeah.
And imagine now, this is now, these are communal farmers who just try to achieve the same yield through the same crop every year. And the monoculture, like you and I had pointed out,
yeah.
drains nutrients from the soils.
Yeah, because you're planting only the same crop over and over again. So yeah. it's the same type of nutrients that keeps, you know, being yeah. used over and over again to the point where it will need some kind of rehabilitation for it to support the same crop again.
Exactly. Now, the downside here is, Helmut, that the gentleman that went to Kavango West with his agroforestry idea, he's been there for 2.5 years. The first 2 years was just treating the soil. Let me say it again. If you think you can get into agriculture as...
Be specific. Organic.
Organic. Doesn't yeah. matter. Agriculture or whatever. Mm. Many people think... He even explained it.
Yeah.
Many people think that hearing about the success story, you know, after
yeah, we have this watermelon, and you're yeah. like, yeah, bravo.
Yeah, and everyone was like, oh, I also now want to grow watermelons. I want to see him. And he literally highlighted it there. You will first sweat buckets of pressure. You will first cry tears of anxiety. He literally said it was just treating or firstly laying the foundation. 2 years. Now, in 2 years, Hamoud, Namibia can go through climate change. In 2 years, you know, climate change can forget to drop a drop of rainfall in your area.
Yeah.
For 2 years, he had to sit with the scenario of, you know, what does this particular picture look like? I was actually going like, and technically the 2.5 years, the half part.
Yeah.
Was him actually seeing the, what do you call it? The fruits of his efforts.
Yeah.
You know, seeing the produce being grown. The lettuces. No, not the lettuces. What was it? The broccolis. The broccolis are another side story as well. Because apparently no one in Kavango West eats broccoli.
Look. He should have,
He Look, should have done, and he said it. He should have done market research.
Forget market research. He should have asked me.
Look, he did not know you and I are here.
Look, that's like me going to some outskirts in Spain and planting mutete.
And asking them, do you want some? Do you want to buy mutete? And they go like, what?
Do you want to buy what?
Yeah. So.
But he went to come on. Broccoli?
He grew all this broccoli.
First of all, the first thing I will have to work on is how to pronounce the thing.
He grew all the broccoli. Do you know what was the only thing? Because apparently in southern Angola and that part of Namibia,
yeah.
People eat the leaves of broccoli. They use it as some sort of a herb in preparing food.
Not the flowery part.
Not the main thing. No. He was like, and he said no one even wanted it for free because when he couldn't sell his crop, The people didn't even want it for free.
Because they didn't know what to do with it.
They didn't know what it
was. Okay, how do you prepare broccoli? That would be the first question that I would be like...
You just water boil it.
Water boil it?
Yeah, that's all.
Yeah, that's the...
Or you steam it.
And then it tastes like water. Look, you have to understand...
It's wonderful, Helmut. It's one of the most wonderful... what do you call that thing? Veggies.
That's the white part of you talking. Look, the things... Okay, can we talk about... Look, the moment you say that, it sort of like reminded me of this other time when one of this, at some point in one of those, one of the northern regions, when people saw a husky and ran away. Now, the thing is,
you are alone. You are alone there.
Look, it's exposure. And the reason why I'm pointing that out, because I know my Ivambo friends that just listened to you say that statement about broccoli. I'm never going to hear the end of it. Now, so they didn't want it. They didn't want it for free.
No, they didn't want to buy it first because they didn't know what it was. And then when he said, "Okay, I can't sit with the stock. Can I give it to you for free?" They were like, right? "We don't even want it for free because we don't know what it is."
Dude, this was supposed to be a serious show,
but it actually shows. It actually shows, Helmut, what farmers can go through.
Yeah,
because if you don't know what people want. Or even where you can sell the thing.
Yeah.
What can you do?
Peugeot. Commercial break.
It's time to win your share of 500,000 Namibian dollars in prizes with Windhoek Beer. Find one of the 100% real quotes broadcast across Namibia on billboards, in stores, in newspapers, and on social media. Buy any Windhoek Beer, SMS the underliner code to 75050, or scan the QR code to enter on WhatsApp. So, spot a quote, grab a Windhoek Beer, and you could win. Windhoek, real beer for real people. Not for persons under the age of 18. Enjoy responsibly. T's and C's apply.
No matter where you are, if you have a mobile device, you can tune into Namibia's number one talk radio station by downloading the Eagle FM app on the Google Play Store or on the Apple App Store. Download the Eagle FM app to tune into live Eagle FM programming or to listen to podcasts of previous broadcasts. Eagle FM, Namibia's number one talk radio station.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news?
Welcome back. The time is 5 o'clock on the dot. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Home Run with Helmut and Dwight, and this is Eagle FM.
Apparently HD says broccoli is not wonderful. Broccoli is wonderful.
Thank you.
What are you guys talking about? I mean,
well, because there are those of us that have, attended an event and were given a plate with that thing on. First of all, it looked more greener than it was in the garden. And it's like,
Helmut, this thing is wonderful. Broccoli to eat.
Let's keep going back to my mutete example in Spain. That's the situation that you are dealing with here.
People are saying broccoli is not wonderful. Broccoli is wonderful to eat.
And it's
one of the I think it's
nutritious. That and avocado, I know.
Yeah, it and cauliflower.
Cauliflower is the white one, right?
Yeah, it's the white one.
Broccoli is the green one, but they look somewhat very similar.
Yeah. Broccoli is wonderful, guys.
In Europe?
No, not in Europe. Even here in Namibia.
Okay, in Windhoek.
Yeah, even in Namibia.
Well, one thing that's been proven is that in Kurunguru it doesn't work. But,
you can make lovely salads from broccoli. I mean, there's a garlic parmesan roasted broccoli.
Do you have... Okay.
Now it's an AI vegetable, apparently.
Look, a lot of people that are in rural Namibia, because I can use that example because I'm exposed to that, especially with my region.
Yeah.
Look, it's about it's about something that I think it's about familiarity, because I remember the first time I didn't eat, I didn't like pizza the same way that I do now.
Mm.
Because I tasted cheese the first time and it just didn't go well with me. Because when you taste it for the first time, it tastes like, yikes, what is this? But, with time, I got used to it.
The only thing with pizza that always annoys me is the price tag.
That's something else. And it's the same, I've run into people at events that tested mayonnaise and thought, because of the vinegar in. Yeah, they were like, are you sure this is not rotten? And there are a lot of people that are deep in the villages listening that are just laughing as loud as you are, if not louder, because they know what I'm talking about.
So, in many cases, many of them probably went and experimented with a bottle of mayonnaise to say, how do you apply it? You can eat it like that on a slice of bread. Do you know the mayonnaise consists of eggs?
I eat it like that with eggs, but I prefer peanut butter. You know, it goes way back when, you know, when you're just farming the whole thing. And, you know, when someone is planting it in the garden, you are digging it out for your personal gratification. But... Okay, let's talk about fertilizer.
I'm lost on that, but okay. Yeah, you were still on the fertilizer.
I think the organic, okay, the whole organic fertilizer thing is an interesting discussion to have. And if you look at the report coming out of the, of an institution, it's Swiss. And it's a research institute of organic agriculture, FIB. The IFOM long definition, long abbreviation is in German. So I just looked at a lot of dots and that, and I couldn't really put two and two together on that one. So let me just take a detour before I come back to the market, to the market access discussion.
Mm.
And maybe, you know, we can, I'm sure we're going to keep coming back to this, to the broccoli discussion. So in Africa, if you look at it I just forgot to share this report with you. This is a report that was done, it's titled The World of Organic Agriculture, Statistics and Emerging Trends 2025. And one thing that it points out is that in Africa, interesting map about the practice or the application of the use of organic fertilizer in large scale agricultural practices on the African continent. Namibia seems to be somewhere in between. Botswana and Angola and Madagascar and basically the entire part of Central Africa going northwards is very clear in terms of the application or the use of organic farming, but East Africa in East Africa we only have parts of Ethiopia. Egypt, on the other hand, it turns out is a Egypt is almost dark blue.
From organic.
Namibia is just in light blue. You have Namibia, South Africa. Going back to Zambia, Zimbabwe, Madagascar. And the Sahel region. Those guys are practicing organic.
They are.
But, if there's any country that is, should actually, be using inorganic agriculture inorganic agriculture because they don't have a very fertile enough soil because of a large part of it is desert, is countries that are in the Sahel region. Like Mauritania minus Mauritania, I don't know, apart from slave trade, I don't know what else they're doing there. But that report points out that the transition of current agriculture and food system from their current suboptimal state of more productive, resilient, and healthy dietary based system is increasingly evident. Focus on ecological organic agriculture EOA in Africa. One of the ways of achieving the transition continues to receive attention from various stakeholders. Now, when it comes to working on silos, one of the reports that coming out of the about the Ministry of Agriculture, coming out of the the Auditor General's office was how the, you know, the Ministry of Agriculture still uses inorganic fertilizer, which is slowly creating a problem for the Ministry of Environment, because inorganic fertilizer has been shown to have a lot of negative impacts or negative effects on the environment. Mm. So now you have this more like we're not pulling in the same direction. Now, again, going back to elementary agriculture, anyone that did the basics of agriculture understands that there are advantages and advantages that you are required to know in terms of the two main forms of fertilizer, that's organic and inorganic. Mm-hmm. When it comes to organic, one of the advantages that anyone can, or more like most of us can remember, is it's environmentally friendly. And inorganic, but the thing is, it takes a very long time to break down compared to inorganic agriculture or inorganic fertilizer, which it doesn't take very long for it to break down and basically be absorbed. Now, when you look at this two comparison, you are looking at this and going like, this is kind of very, mind-numbingly difficult to practice on a large scale, which is now training individuals to basically carry out these serious activities. Because on a large scale, you can imagine the number of, the size of labor you're going to need to practice organic organic fertilizer, to apply organic fertilizer on a large scale. And if you look at machines that are used in agriculture, I don't think we have a lot of them that are tailored towards the application of organic fertilizer. A lot of machines that we have in the agricultural world are tailored towards the spreading of inorganic fertilizer. So you are talking about
remember back to the Mexico discussion. The Mexico US
GMO US discussion
dispute.
Yeah.
Do you remember what was the core complaint that Mexico highlighted
there? Your GMO corn is used in the primary diet and it's giving my people cancer.
Yeah, plus the GMO is blocking the organically produced corn from being sold.
Because it's easily mass-produced and it's much cheaper, as you can imagine.
Yeah. And there's also, obviously, sectoral interests, meaning the lobbyists.
As you know,
those are obviously, investing.
Funding everything.
Yeah. And the organic guys were saying, hey, listen, we can grow so many variants of the same product. You can get a pink one, you can get an orange one, you can get a green one. I don't want to see a green corn cob, please.
Me neither.
That would just be disastrous. But there was to know that there's more than just yellow and white corn.
When they can be different varieties.
When they can be different varieties based upon the soil, based upon the type of the thing, based upon the various other climatic conditions in Mexico, for example. You can, if you're on the eastern side of the country, you can produce that one that is like orange and red. The orange and red corn cob.
So the same thing we have like with the different types of apples or
that too. Yeah. And if I'm on the other side on the western side of Mexico, I'm producing the yellow and slightly orange one, or the yellow and purple one. You remember the purple one, the deep red.
Yeah.
That technically looks purple to your eye. I mean, guys, you should have seen what Helmut and I obviously saw, because obviously through an audio medium, you have to do your utmost best to describe what something looks like. And that visualization in that specific report, that trade dispute between the US and Mexico, the Mexicans illustrated the varieties that they can export, which are organically produced.
Yeah.
Now, the organic side of things obviously means that you need to stick to a specific schedule, a specific regimen. Now, many people don't obviously, associate regimen with what this particular schedule cites, but it is unique because you have to ask the question, if we're going this way, do I look after the environment? Do I look after the soil, the nutrients in the soil?
Yeah.
It's not airy-fairy stuff. No. It's literally a scenario of you going an extra level in management.
Yeah.
In resource management. Because the first lady, in the panel discussion of the gaining access to a market, the people from Malta here, the lady from Malta here. Her particular scenario was converting from animal husbandry to crop farming. So it was someone that literally moved from animal husbandry to now becoming a crop producer in Malta here. Do you know how dry it is there? You remember when I explained to you how hot it gets in Utusep?
Uh-huh.
They're in that national park there outside Walvis Bay. There where the sun has no mercy. Your plant, if you grow any plants there, your plant wilts just from the hot wind. Not even from sunlight, because you would have put up your nets and your stuff to try and, you know, soften the ultraviolet light impact on the plant so as to mitigate or to combat the higher rate of moisture evaporation from the plant. Ah, bruh. There's a hot wind that blows in from the Nama over that riverbed, that dry riverbed, and it hits your plant.
So the the wind or the air is devoid of any humid
moisture, or devoid of any moisture.
So no moisture, no humidity in the environment because, well, there's no rain.
Exactly.
Oh dear.
And it's not just about the rain, but before we go on, you know, I can see the ad break.
Yep.
The best connections and moments are worth remembering, don't you think? Grab one of our great-tasting non-alcoholic drinks, Heineken, Savannah, Vintage Original, or Vintage Lemon. Anytime, anywhere. Easy to connect. Easy to enjoy. Not for persons under the age of 18. Enjoy responsibly.
Great news. Imba just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just $36 a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
Welcome back. It's 16 minutes past the hour of 5, and we're still on the organic fertilizer or organic fertilizer in the in agricultural practices, but most putting more emphasis on finding the market. I think every time the discussion of organic farming, especially with regards to to organic fertilizer comes up, I'm looking at it like it's a, it's a mammoth undertaking to, to try and, implement, because you already have a supply chain in existence. Farmers know who's, every farmer, especially on a commercial level, knows who supplies them with insecticide. They know, which insecticide or fertilizer brand that they use. So, bringing organic, organic fertilizer into the equation, especially you're looking at it from, you're talking to a farmer, obviously, not to the guy that supplies them with fertilizer, the inorganic type. Mm. That's now, the farmer now have to deal with, look at, who is, even if I'm willing to, to take the direction in terms of fertilizer, the direction, even if I'm willing to take the direction of organic farming, who is going to be my supplier? Because take for example, if I've done the math and this is how much how much mulch, take for example, that I need per month or per year, who is the supplier? Like again, the question is, who is producing organic fertilizer on a large scale equivalent to the inorganic fertilizer industry?
And it obviously has value chains. It obviously has supply chains.
Yeah.
Because when you look at harsh conditions,
yeah,
or a scenario of harsh conditions, like these producers predominantly. You are citing, obviously, you know, organic and inorganic fertilizers. Now, inorganic fertilizers are easy to access because you find them in a shop.
Yeah.
The shop is supplied by a distributor.
Yeah.
The distributor is supplied by a producer or another distributor. Let's say it's cross-border.
Yeah.
For that matter.
At the end, you're going to run into a manufacturer. Yeah. Large-scale.
Large-scale manufacturer. Now, looking at that length and the petrol price and the distance in terms of how far the thing had to travel, because the thing, the item, the organic, the inorganic fertilizer product stays at least for 6 months to a year in a warehouse.
Yeah.
At least. Somewhere it stays in storage for that long without seeing a market anyway. It's just a unit to be sold or to be moved on when, you know, the channels need the supply. It gets to your shop, Helmut. You probably wanted the thing last month or at the start of the year.
Yeah.
And because you now were now obviously chasing how to produce or to, you know, to convert barren soil, which is very low in nutrition for any plant or for the type of plant you wish to plant there. And you needed the thing back then. Now there's a difference in the price from what you had last month and now you have this month. However, if you look at the organic scenario of things, apparently there's a trend in the world, the mulching trend.
Yeah.
People are now somewhat in around the world. Everyone is now kicking up and doing a backyard garden session. I mean, you can even cite when we had Mr. Shipingana here last year on air, he would also tell you about his mulching. Everyone would be just happy about mulching. No, mulching is the way. So mulching and making your own compost are like two different ways of the same thing. You see, with compost, you have to leave the thing there. Mulching is you've got the, what do you call it? The plant bedding, the plant, what do you call those areas, man? I almost said bedding.
Is it the one where you have to dig a pit?
No. It's where the plants are. What do you call that area? Not garden. Garden is the bigger area. But where in the garden your plants are.
Like furrows or something?
Yeah, the plant furrows. Let's use furrows for now.
Yeah.
Mulching helps with containing moisture in the soil.
Yeah.
Because first and foremost, one of the biggest concerns in Namibia is combating evaporation. To combat evaporation, you would need all this excess dead plant material. Like,
to cover the soil so that it traps the moist as soon as it leaves.
But then you've got to wet, you've got to water it so that the water flows off it, and then it acts as a barrier against evaporation from the soil, and any moisture that's on it can probably be the sacrificed moisture upwards.
Sacrifice is the correct word for it.
Yeah, which it technically is. It's a sacrificial lamb in that discussion. Now, you can't go around thinking about mulching there in every part of Namibia. Why do I say that? Last year when I started on this organic farming discussion, you know, where we, the media, were invited to this discussion, I showed up where we went to this particular farm here, 10 Ks outside of Ventukia southwards, and they had a compost heap. They weren't mulching, but there was enough grass that you could see. But in any person's mind on a farm, if you have a combination of agriculture, of crop farming and livestock farming, you leave the grass for the livestock. You don't convert edible grass meant for the livestock into mulch for your small backyard garden.
Because then you'll have to figure out what your livestock have to eat.
Exactly.
Out here.
Exactly. Even though the presentation that you and I looked at last year, the one about the other organic farming, animal husbandry.
Yeah.
How the animals were made to move, you know, piece by piece by piece, and then graze everything sustainably. And then you wrote, it's literally also once again livestock rotation.
Yeah, like rotational
camp rotation. Yeah.
So you have to, you know, they stay in every, you know, in one camp for a period of time. And
yeah.
Then while the other one is a sort of like a, you know, a recovery.
Yeah. So in that scenario, you can understand, okay, so the grass exclusively becomes grazing for the livestock.
Yeah.
If you've got your backyard garden in that scenario that I observed there, they use a lot of creative means, meaning, let's say kitchen waste, you know, like waste from, vegetable peels and other particular plant material would then be used for generating the compost for the garden. Now, composting is also another particular tricky thing, because composting is also a mechanism in terms of where you could probably have a competitive edge. You see, you can't sell your compost. Because you will ask the question to yourself, you know what? I need to clear that side of the plantation, and it needs the compost there.
Yeah.
Because you will never find anyone that has said that they sold their compost to another farmer. You won't find that, Amit. Composting is probably one of the most sustainable mechanisms you can ever find.
Yeah.
If you did, then that person is just focusing on compost. They're not growing anything.
Yeah, they're just
The reason why people compost and, you know, and mulch is to be self-sustainable. Have you ever seen it?
Compost?
No, people selling.
Selling, the compost.
Because I've also never seen that example.
Yeah, me neither.
I know people compost because they don't like the inorganic prices in the shop.
Well, they're high.
Well, you know, each one to their own specifically about, you know, what is the perception on high?
Now, there's something that I want to bring up here, and that is sort of like there's a type of soil that was archaeologists always butting heads over that was found in the Amazon rainforest, and it's called it's known as Terra Prata or Amazonian black earth. It's basically organic fertilizer type. But the components, or more like the type of plants that were put together to achieve this type of fertilizer, can easily be, let's just be conservative and say, can easily be guessed. But the biggest problem is the microbes that's present in that soil is not found in the surrounding soil. Now, the thing is, how they managed to put all this together, and this is, now we're talking about prehistoric here, how they managed to put this together, no one basically have any clue. The best we can do is estimate. I think what's happening is, we are, you know, as we start having a conversation around, we only have one planet Earth, and if we screw it up, well, we are screwing ourselves in the process. So, how then do we practice all our daily activities in a way that, we don't commit mass suicide, literally. Yeah. So, to pull that off, you have this trend that we are seeing around the world, and that's the appreciation of everything that's environmentally friendly. From transportations, we are talking about EVs, albeit the environmentally friendly, and that one is very debatable, seeing that everything starts with mining. When you look at it, the turn in the direction of everything organic is an interesting one, but there's one elephant in the room that we are not addressing. We have basically made a 180 degree turn. We are going back to the time where everything was produced mechanically. Because, if you are going to produce something, take for example fertilizer inorganically, there are assembly plants, or more like there are processing plants across the planet for that. thanks to thanks to that German guy called
Haber-Bosch.
Yeah. The inventor of the Haber process.
Haber-Bosch.
Haber what?
Haber-Bosch.
All I'm hearing is,
Haber and Bosch. It's two guys.
What I'm hearing
the,
is...
The guys that produced ammonia.
Yeah. I'm hearing food. Now, you see, I know. Look, in this, somewhere mid-1800s, there's a series of islands, along the coastlines of Chile, about 30-something kilometers. Now, this is in a very arid environment, and there are types of birds known as, is it Guane Cormoran? Now, the thing is, the Spanish and the Americans basically went, were this close. I think to some degree there was, exchange of fire because of the, because of the bird droppings, because it was discovered that it was very, very, very rich in nitrogen.
Mm.
Now, this was before the discovery of, the synthetic processing of nitrogen into fertilizer. So, what the Europeans then discovered was that, the more their population expanded, the more they needed a large scale agricultural activities. Now, the thing is, and we have all seen Europe on a map. They were running, they didn't have, enough land to sort of like, leave this piece of land and then go, clear a new one that you have to practice your agriculture on. And, that, as you can imagine, is going to come with a lot of labor and a lot of expenses. So a fertilizer idea then was needed.
Mm-hmm.
So, thanks to the Prussians, the Germans, and the guys that also, by the way, gave the news to, of the presence of that, golden, bed droppings in, the side of South America. The gentleman known as Alexander von Humboldt, well, also Prussian, aka German. Now, so for both the discovery of that and, the perfection into the purification or synthesizing into the breaking down of nitrogen, you can thank the Germans for that. Now, here's the thing. What we are looking at here is organic farming is taking us back to square one, where you need a large number of workforce if you want to practice it on a large scale.
Mm.
Well, we're talking about establishing a supply chain from the get-go. Again, this takes us back to the back to the discussion we had about organic fertilizer last year. Every farmer, one thing that was pointed out by the gentleman, I think that, that you were talking to was that, farmers are just asking, most farmers are more reluctant to adopt organic farming for very obvious reasons. The method they have is working.
Yep.
Yeah.
It hasn't broken.
Yep. It's working. So if you are going to convince them to change, you better have a very compelling argument. But right now, the argument of organic fertilizer is, especially as it stacks in contrast with the inorganic fertilizer, is not a very strong one when you talk about things from, from a large scale agricultural activity standpoint, because everyone knows that, like you pointed out, the supply chain, every farmer, commercial farmer, knows that this is the type of crops that I farm with. This is the type of fertilizer, inorganic, that these crops needs. This is the supplier. Now, where the supplier gets his stuff, whether it's from a manufacturer, they also know that. Now, we're talking about basically breaking that up so that we can come up with one that's environmentally friendly. It's a brilliant idea.
Mm.
Except you are now, that's sort of like we have a simulation of that going on in the transport industry, where you are looking at, you have an internal combustion engine. That's working. It's not broken.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, with all the noise, it's loved and revered. Now you are asking someone to change from that to an EV. what is one of the most, more like enticing thing that is, that's put out there for, to sort of like convince people to transition from an internal combustion engine to an EV? Easy. You can plug that thing in your living room.
Yeah, but are the people willing to pay the price?
Exactly.
For the EV?
Yeah, we talked about that last year. We all came to the same plan. Now, when you look at the price tag on an EV, you can buy two internal combustion engine cars, and everyone will be like, okay, fine, I'll just get two internal combustion engine.
And you'll still be able to afford the... you'll still be able to afford the petrol even. You'll be able to afford even the insurance. But you definitely... Many people say, nah, the EV is way, way too expensive.
It's... And it is expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, look, it's a good thing, the transition from organic, from inorganic to organic. Mm. It's a good thing. But its feasibility in terms of large scale application, it's going to give everyone a headache.
Mm. It is. It is. And the downside of the headache scenario.
Yeah.
Is obviously trying to convince ever more people. Because here's the thing, Hamu. We don't even know whether or not the good rains that Namibia experienced will persist into the new rainy season. At the heart of a discussion is how does you producing in your backyard garden or in your, now trying to get to the organic side of things, how does that factor into the costs or the inputs? Yes, much of the particular testimony cited at the particular discussion, the conference that took place, dear listeners, last week, they all cited it pays off in some extent. But here's a good example of trying to get to a market where things are established. Now, the guy that I explained to you, the guy that went to Kavango West with the broccoli,
He just replaced the Oshakati door.
He's now become our meme. He shouldn't listen to us. He explained that his neighbor, the people that had the plantation, the depleted land that he started on.
Yeah.
They tried.
The one he rehabilitated for 2 years.
Yeah. His neighbor is one of the watermelon producers.
Yeah.
The governor was impressed.
All
with,
over,
like watermelon juice, woohoo, we're coming. That guy
sound like the governor said.
His neighbor
contacted
and tried to find ways of getting to a market because Nkurunkuru slightly also too small, to absorb everything that his neighbor was busy producing.
Mm-hmm.
So they approached one of the well-known retailers here in Namibia. Who actually have a shop in Nkurunkuru. Now he thought that he could just take it to the shop. He take his produce to the shop.
Yeah.
His produce said, nah, there's a buying division of this retailer that you've got to talk to. And then he had to talk to those guys. And those guys said, sure, we've got a truck. We can come pick up. All you need to do is put the watermelons in the appropriate, storage and transportation mechanism, which were cardboard boxes.
Yeah.
And he had to buy a sticker to put on, to label, and there's another particular thing also associated to the packaging that he also had to do. And when the neighbor went and calculated, cost per head or cost per watermelon, he was technically not making anything. Even going full on organic.
Yeah.
And trying to get or gain access to an established market, the neighbor realized that he technically was not making money per watermelon. And then here's the crux of the thing. For the watermelon to get to that shop of the retailer in Nkurunkuru, the watermelon first had to travel to Windhoek to be distributed from Windhoek
by the retail store owners.
Yeah. So collection in Nkurunkuru, driving 600-700 km all the way southwards to Windhoek. Positioning everything now into a overall distribution hub. You load off.
Yeah.
Look, I can understand why. Let me explain why, Hamad.
Please do.
Here's the scenario. If you look at...
Because I was like, why not just take a truck, go straight to the farm?
And take it there straight to the shop. Yeah. But here's the thing. Retailers in the private sector also have their aspect of centralization of data and centralization of costs. So if you've ever seen the model for many of the particular shops, you will sometimes see that one shop doesn't have the exact same goods like the other one. They can be from the same group.
Yeah.
They don't have the exact same goods. They have the basics sorted, milk, bread, meats, and the fruit and veg and fresh produce, and then the sweets and the chocolates part.
Yeah.
But when you start expanding the product offering in them, you realize that there are major differences between them. Yeah, they will have the same colors, the same name, same branding, same signage.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is the same. The people in the store are wearing the same shirts even, you know, like the other shop.
Yeah.
But let's say the other shop is bigger and the other shop is more floor space. And this shop is smaller. The shop is lesser, can stock lesser things. Then there's the other scenario in terms of how are your invoices paid? Because remember, everything on a shelf in a retail store has an invoice. Where are those invoices paid? Are they paid by the shop manager or are they paid by the central unit sitting somewhere in the capital of the country?
Yeah.
Many cases, it's at the central unit. Why? Because let's say, Hamoud, you are in Windhoek. That shop is in Nkurunkuru. But that shop does not have a buyer. The buyer sits with you, which is, in many cases, how you would think of as procurement.
Yeah.
They procure goods. That buyer then cites, okay, I think Helmut's shop in Nkurunkuru needs this product. You don't have a right on what goes onto the shelf there. You don't have a say. You're just the store manager. You don't have a right. Unless the franchise, you are part of a franchise distribution setup.
Yeah.
Then you have a right in terms of what you distribute. But if it's you're part of a larger retail chain that controls everything, you don't have a say in terms of what gets sent by a truck to you. Yeah. All you can say is, my milk supply is running low. I need milk supply.
Then they
my sugar supply is low. I need sugar. All you will do is just send reports through to the suppliers. The suppliers give you the invoices. You send those invoices to Windhoek, the central command, because they sit with a bank account there.
Yeah.
And then they do all payments. So I understood why that truck had to be dispatched from Windhoek, drive to Nkurunkuru, pick up the watermelons, then drive to Windhoek. Drive back to Windhoek, sort it, place it here for...
Put it back.
For, what do they call it? Inventory.
Yeah.
Inventory management, which is your logistics... No, it's not logistics. Inventory management is the part before, because you get supply chain management as the one discipline. Logistics and channel management is the other discipline. And you get inventory and warehousing management, which is the other discipline. Ask me how I know this, Helmut, because they broke up one course of mine into three courses. I'm so heartbroken. That's how I know all about this. They broke up one course of mine into three
divisions.
Into four courses, actually. They took the marketing and put it one side, and they broke up the distribution, channel management, and logistics management into these three things that I'm mentioning now.
Yeah.
In that level, in those three levels that I mentioned to you, the goods get scanned in, so they get fed into the database of inventory, and then only do they get dispatched to where you actually wanted to see your watermelon. Now, you would not even know if you're that Nkurunkuru guy or that Kavango West guy. You wouldn't even know if your watermelon is the Marintal watermelon on your shelf or if it's your watermelon on your shelf. Now, do you understand why this...
So, it's a structural and organizational thing.
Yeah, but it works for the entity that you're supplying to.
Yeah.
It doesn't work for you. It's not a scenario of whether or not you like it or don't like it, because at the ultimate end of the thing is you get paid for the stock that you supply.
Yeah, plus that's their internal inner working methods.
Yeah.
That's how they do things.
Yeah.
And I think also to some degree it can be argued that it's an accountability issue. So if it turns out that someone buys a faulty product, they should be able to know what is going on. They don't want to know, they don't want to go like, well, we're just sitting in Windhoek. Those things are just bought, somewhere there, and we our oversight on those products, since we're very far away from it geographically, it's limited.
Yeah.
So I think it also comes in, brings in an accountability issue. So that makes a lot of sense. It's a logistical nightmare, though.
Yeah, it is. It is. Because in between, the products also go off if they are freshly produced.
Mm-hmm.
The products sometimes do not get bought. So you sometimes know the retailer carries a whole set of risks, specifically when it comes to
the specific product,
the freshness of the product. What's the word that we use? A perishable good. A perishable good is a product that can go off.
Spoil.
Yeah, it can spoil. And when it comes to perishable goods, there's always a high risk of damage to the product, damage to the feel of it. Like, for example, I only discovered somewhere at the start of this year, in South Africa, the products that you don't buy from the shelf, the ones that have a spot here or a blemish here or that like overripe, they're the ones that end up in your tomato sauces, in your chutneys.
This is basically processed.
Yeah. They are the ones diverted to processing. The very good ones are the ones that you see the auntie in the shop picking up and pressing, she's putting her indentations into the thing and you're like, brah, I also want it. why are we busy stress testing a tomato?
It's a tomato.
Yeah. So that's a grade of the product that you get. The other grade gets diverted into other, agro-processing methods. That's if we had adequate agro-processing going on. But anyway, it's still a work in process.
Don't worry. All we just need is vote in one specific political party, and we'll have a processing plant in every constituency. But look, the whole discussion of organic farming, it's a good one, but it's always going to have one very giant fork in the road. And that is,
Is it a fork or is it sort of like a stumbling block?
Actually, this is not a fork. This is a trident, the one for Poseidon.
Mm.
Because it's that big. Asking someone to change something that works, if I was a commercial farmer and someone was, everything was working in the way that I practice my agriculture, and someone was telling me, if you can change to this labor intensive and very difficult to find, difficult to source in terms of organic fertilizer, like you just pointed out, you don't know anyone that sells, that have, sold mulch, for example. And producing organic fertilizer on a large scale, as you can imagine, is going to bring up a lot of deforestation discussions.
Oh, yes.
Yep.
And a lot of, what is that thing's name? Desertification?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's going to enhance that conversation.
Because what you're trying to do here is cut a lot of grass that you can then use to cover furrows, for example. And then, so that you can prevent the moisture that's in that soil from escaping, aka evaporating. So you're basically trapping them. You're creating like a mini atmosphere. I think to some degree can easily be described as that's the same thing that our atmosphere does. It ensures that the water that we have doesn't float off into space, because if that happened, boy, would be cooked. So you have all these, all these layers of air to basically trap all this moisture and then, bring it back again. So that makes a lot of sense. Environmental wise,
yeah,
it makes a lot of sense. Climate change wise, it makes a lot of sense. But labor intensive wise, every farmer will be like, okay, we'll have to go back to John Deere, for example, and then ask them if they can, ask their engineers to start investing in research and development to see if they can come up with a machine that can help us do this on a large scale.
Mm.
Because, again, do you have any mulch making machine?
I did. I made mulch the other day, Hamad. All I did was clear out the backyard, take the grass that was growing there, which many people would say, those are weeds. Picked it up, put it in the plant fodder, so, as we call it, the, you know, those.
So all we just need is a weed.
Weeds. Not weed. Weeds.
Sorry. Weeds.
Not the holy herb, Helmut.
You know, had to go to Jamaica for a couple of seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, look.
But that's not, if you've got the property, if you've got the land. Because what now happens if you're someone that has to do, raised bedding agriculture, or you've got to have these structured, what do you call those things? I keep forgetting that word, man. Those containers, those raised, yeah, raised beddings, yeah. No, it's not raised beddings. Raised gardens, yeah, raised gardens. Let's just go with raised gardens.
I think, look, I think the conclusion that a lot of people are going to reach every time that we look at inorganic, like organic agricultural practices is that on a large scale, it's a nightmare. On a small scale, it's somewhat feasible. So we are talking about this could reduce or bring an end to commercial agriculture. And believe me, if you look at the amount of money that goes into commercial agriculture, I don't think there's a commercial farmer out there that would be like, okay, fine. You can just fragment my farm into a million pieces because, you know, in the name of the environment. No. But I think that's where one of those challenges we will have to, that's going to take a while to implement. But, environmental-wise, does it make sense? Yeah. But then, the thing is, when you look at into organic, you know, inorganic farming, I think whether we like it or not, we are going to, whatever option that we choose to practice on a large scale, we are going to pay, the there are consequences at the end of the road. If we go the inorganic way, the environment is ruined. And that is actually, if you look at it in, you know, in long-term, in a long-term sense, it's not bad, it's worse. I'm suspecting COVID-25, but,
Yeah.
So the thing is, whatever method that we take, they say, in whatever you are does, there's some consequence.
What was
consequence. And someone was trying to say consequences.
Another meme, ne?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In whatever you are does, there's some consequence. But, again, it's, but when it comes to market access, I think, market access for crops that you produce with organic, organic means or organic methods. Please familiarize yourself with the environment. The natives, what do they eat?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or the locals, not even natives.
Yeah, the locals.
You're making this sound like, you know, Charles Darwin landing and.
Discovering things that are already where people are.
Yeah, people were looking at, yeah, we know that's a lizard, you know, it's just abnormally large, but you know what? Yeah, to us it's a crocodile, it's a dinosaur, yeah, we know it.
We know all the basics, if you get much close to it, it's gonna eat you, so that's enough for us.
You'll be Sunday lunch, so just stay away. Yeah, the concern obviously, Helmut, is one based upon what does the person want to do? Because I can find, for example, I watched the other day a weird, very weird snippet of a larger documentary. It's actually a cuisine documentary of southern Italy.
Yeah.
And it's in a region of southern Italy known as Puglia. Helmut, there's a husband and wife restaurant. Everything they source is organically grown. 0 kilometer distance. Everything that they sell you on the plate of food you buy is sourced from a radius of 0 kilometers away.
There's one, I watched a video last week of one Russian girl that made a video that, the first time she moved to the US, she was shocked to find out that, you can't just hop in your car and then drive to any farm to buy milk.
No. You can't do that. But in other parts of the world, you can do that.
Yeah, she did point that out that, where I come from, if you want to buy milk, you can just go directly to the farmer. Mm-hmm. You don't have to deal with a bunch of license of, you know, what chemical makeup does this milk have and it digestive, blah, blah, blah. No.
No, but
just go directly to the farmer, get the this, you're basically being your own health inspector here.
Yeah, through you and your belly.
Yeah, through you and your belly.
Yeah.
And now,
you and your intestines, your belly, your stomach.
Now, look, as someone that was raised in rural areas, that shocked me. That shocked me too. I was like, wait, the only place you can source milk is in a grocery store. You can't hop in your car, drive to the farm and get the milk.
Mm-hmm.
How'd that become a law? Because it's milk.
I mean, Helmut, the indication obviously has been people have become used to the idea that you go to the shop for milk. You don't go to the farmer for milk. Now, for those of us, for example, mm-hmm. people who are not Helmut and Dwight, who have not seen a goat or goat's milk or had lovely mealy-meal porridge, the only time I would, you know, actually become hungry is having top score in the morning with goat's milk.
Oh boy, it's delicious.
Absolutely wonderful. And freshly squeezed, eh?
Uh-huh.
I feel sorry for the, you know, for the goat's kid, you know, who was hoping to have breakfast that morning and then Dwight needed a nice cup of coffee with mom's milk. Anyway, so people don't know those things. But however, if you're in Europe, if you're in Africa, if you're in South America, if you're in Asia, people know about accessing directly from a farmer. And the farmer knows that they've got a role to play in selling directly to a market.
Yeah.
Now, that's obviously the disconnect that of some of the organic examples here in Namibia.
How long do you have to buy from a grocery store to think that a cabbage is from the grocery store, not from the farm?
I don't know. I really don't know. Because another thing I wanted to tell you, Helmut, is that in that same Italian documentary about cuisine in a specific region of Italy, do you know that they don't pull out when they harvest the fresh produce? But they don't pull out the thing with its root system.
Yeah.
They cut it off. So that the thing.
It's so like pruning so that it can just grow from.
Exactly. You just take what you need. You don't pull out the thing. What do we do in Namibia?
Oh no, I'll take this one. And you pull it out, put it on make a large heap of it.
Yeah.
Set it on fire. Yeah. And then.
And you know what's even the worst part? Then you come back tomorrow and you replant again.
Oh yeah. Like, look, we need a whole new paradigm of doing this.
A whole new paradigm. What political language is that?
Yeah.
It's just people seeing, you know, looking somewhere else potentially to improve on a specific mechanism. Because if I tell you now, you don't have to go and pull the whole broccoli plant out. Yes, there would be some detractors about broccoli. Just like I would have some detracts, like my own detraction specifically about what's the thing's name? I like it. Just not every day.
What's that? Cucumber?
No, potatoes and butternut.
I like potatoes.
I actually love sweet potato.
Oh yeah, sweet potato.
I love sweet, but a potato and a butternut. I
don't know what type of starch you are. If you are going for a marathon, sure. But if you are just, that's a lot.
Look, a potato is a super healthy thing.
Yeah, it is.
Because potato can be the replacement for, you know, these vegan guys, these vegetarians.
For?
When they need iron. Since they don't eat meat, and meat contains iron and protein.
Yeah.
A potato can be the supplement, just like peanuts as well.
I'm just going to stick with the liver on this one.
They won't even touch the livers. But you know what? It's one of the reasons why I believe, you know, there's more for me and less
for them.
And the aspect in terms of me sharing my commiserations and sympathies
You know, it's all there. Because I've seen the negative. There was a Russian girl in Vietnam who lived on a diet. She was a vlogger. Everyday, daily blogger, but using video. She vlogged about how she was just living on a completely fruit-based diet. Do you know how skinny that
is? Why?
Girl? I don't know.
The vlogger, so I'm going to go with views.
She passed away at the start of this year because of an unhealthy, non-well-balanced diet.
You need protein.
You always need protein.
Cabana is an excellent sauce.
You'll always need starch. You will even need a chicken in your life somewhere.
Yep.
Not an orange. Even though a chicken does produce vitamin C. You know, chicken soup.
Oh, hence the chicken soup and cold.
Yeah. But you won't just live off citrus fruits the whole day.
Now, one of the biggest source of, one of the biggest plant source of protein is lentils. And I eat them a lot. But yeah. There's one thing, one thing a lot of health experts have pointed out over and over again is that the protein that you find in there and the one that you have in meat, they have a slight difference in chemical makeup. And one that's in meat is much more easier for your body to deal with than the one that's in lentils.
Yeah.
They can deal with it, but it's somewhat more, it requires extra work. I was like, okay, fine. I'll just take both and do a combo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you still get the best out of both worlds.
Yeah, but vegetarian. I don't know. I'm just saying it's not for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From now, I'm going to keep you on that side of the studio, ne?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do that.
That's how I felt last week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm beginning
and to. And even yesterday on Sunday.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
But anyway, yeah.
Yeah. Market access. When it comes to the produce that you are producing via organic means, I think it's safe to say that's at least more basic more basic in comparison. Like, just do your market research, find out what is mostly eaten. If you want to, what's mostly eaten, because if it's mostly eaten, it's going to be bought a lot if you produce it on a large scale. And I think even the grocery stores in that environment, when they find out that you are producing it on a large scale, it will be very easy for you to sell that idea. But when it comes to the producing the fertilizer now for you to the fertilizer from in its organic form, the supply chain of that doesn't exist.
No.
I don't know any if it exists. The supply chain of that doesn't exist. So, that gives us it creates a dilemma. Like, do you establish it because it doesn't have, you don't have anyone to compete with? Because it could be an opportunity for something new, given the environmental protectionism going on around the world. It could be something new. But the question is, are you up to the task? Because that's the first question you have to ask yourself. Because that's going to require a lot. A lot. Of effort.
It is. And it's actually going to also...
It took your homeboy 2 years to rehabilitate the land.
It was a long time now. Depleted.
Now, if that soil was your source of.
Imagine yourself.
Was your only source of food.
Imagine yourself.
You don't have 2 years to refer.
Yeah, you don't have. If you're a communal farmer, you don't have the luxury of 2 years.
No, you don't.
You are stuck. You are literally stuck. But. If you had the luxury of waiting 2 years, I don't know what you were eating. We didn't ask.
That's someone. Look, I'm not a Bible scholar, but I've come to learn that even our Lord and Savior just fasted for 40 days and 40 nights, not 2 years. So that means...
That guy was chewing on something at least.
Look, that means unless you have, take for example, another portion of land, to sort of help you kickstart your organic, farming practice. That's going to be somewhat very challenging. But, on a communal level, I think it's, we're not at that point where we are using a large amount of inorganic fertilizer yet. And not even at the level where we're using, large scale, insecticide or herbicides. When it comes to dealing with weeds, for example, we still use the traditional mechanical removal, like the physical removal of the weed. Mm. We are not spraying in some chemical that will selectively kill the weeds and leave the crop that we desire to cultivate or the crop that we cultivate with. So that transition could be it's much easier, I think, to assist small scale farmers like communal farmers to with the transition. From the use of organic fertilizer. Now that's going to take also a training, which I think it's safe to say that Tateji Pingana have done have been doing for a while now. Because more often when I used to call him, I think that was last year, he would be talking from the Zambezi region, where he would be assisting local farmers to show them how to make a compost, how to make a compost, for example.
Mm.
So it's much easier to pull off on a small scale, but on a large scale, take 300 hectares, for example.
You don't need 300 hectares.
That's a lot.
It's a lot of land. Grass. Yeah, but it's a lot of land. You don't need 300 hectares.
How much hectares do you need to produce something on a large scale?
I mean, one of the organic farmers there, two ladies, they had something like 8 hectares or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they needed.
Yeah.
Even the guy, 2.5 years.
Yeah.
Also had like less than 10 hectares or close to 10 hectares.
What's one of the biggest commercial farm, in our country?
20,000 hectares, 20 to 30,000. It goes to a price of at least 20 to 30 million.
Is that a crop or animal farming?
That's just surface area. So if you see how big the surface area is,
yeah,
you immediately assume it's animal.
Mm-hmm.
30,000. That is a lot of land.
That's a lot of land.
That's a lot of land.
And that's okay. I think you should just okay. Should we just remove hectares at this point and just start saying 30,000 soccer fields?
Yeah. How much does 30,000 soccer fields look like in anyone's eyes? How big is 30,000 soccer fields? They'll go like one soccer field.
Like,
no, not the stadium, just the field you play on.
Yeah, the pitch.
That's your hectare. How many hectares?
30,000 of them.
That's a lot. That's a lot.
Now, look. It's one of those things, if you ask me, that it's a good thing to see that, it's being practiced, by a lot of African countries, African countries, including ours. And achievements from the report that I just cited, achievements by an African organic network or AfroNet, they have a lot of presence in East Africa. African Organic Network, AfroNet, is a pan-African umbrella organization created in 2012 to bring organic hectares to network and foster the growth of the African organic sector. And its core activities includes organizing policy dialogue and capacity building, information dissemination, and providing support for organic value chain development and trade. Value chain development and trade. The value chain is still under development. This building is still under construction, and like everything else that's still under development, I think it's safe to say, the EV industries are still under development, because we still have a lot of internal combustion engine guys running, waking people up with their loud engines at 3 o'clock in the morning. The umbrella network creates alliance with a national, a regional, and a continental network, a movement and association to advance organic agriculture in Africa. Now, that organization, AfroNet is a member of IFOM, the Swiss organization that compiled this report.
Yeah.
Now, the part that the part that caught my attention here is that now this is basically in line with with IFOM's goal, which is to advocate for the large scale use of organic farming. In large scale use of organic farming, its core activities includes organizing policy dialogue, because everything is going to go down to policy. I mean, you and I, after going through the Ministry of Agriculture report coming out of the Auditor General's office, pointed out that the way that the Ministry of Agriculture is practicing agriculture is, the elephant in the room is, in a long run, it's going to create a lot of problems for the Ministry of Environment.
Yeah.
And they will have to deal with it.
In the long run, they're creating their own particular set complications.
Yeah.
Because they're supposed to achieve environmental sustainability.
Yeah.
By not using
things that causes environmental unsustainability.
Yeah. So, there's a lot of particular things.
Call for policies. They call for organizing policy dialogues, capacity building, because everything is going to come down to policy. Yeah, capacity building, information dissemination, sort of like why, even though it's a lot to do, why in a long run organic farming is actually a good idea compared to inorganic.
Mm.
Yeah, because when it rains, all those inorganic chemicals are in your water system. Then you're dealing with a serious, a wider ecological problem, not only impacting humans, but, all those chemicals have been known to creep into the, different food chains of insects and animals and birds and all that. And it causes all kinds of health problems. So it has a lot of short-term advantages, but the long-term disadvantages will actually make everyone look at that and go like, organic is a lot of work to do, but in a long run, it's worth it.
Yeah, it ultimately is. You can't yet say if everyone will latch onto the idea.
Mm-mm.
But it is at least a step up, Helmut, from the discussion we had last year, where we just had one farmer to choose from. Here we literally had access to four or five farmers that shared their particular success stories, or their specific, long walks to freedom stories regarding how to get things going, firstly.
Yeah.
And it all points towards a scenario of people need food. You have to produce food. And if you're just looking at animal husbandry as your be-all and end-all, you might have to mix and match a little bit in terms of, also growing, having a small garden or something,
mm-hmm.
or small plantation starting off small. At least you'll have access to cow dung or some sort of animal dung to help, resuscitate any depleted soil of nutrients. But further on from that, we still have to watch this particular space.
I think it's one of those things that's going to take a while, but you don't have to be an expert to basically look at the two methods of of crop farming in terms of fertilizer and just come to the realization that long term, one of them has a lot of advantages short term, but long-term, like really long-term disadvantages. And that's the inorganic part. And that's the reason why we're dealing with, that's the reason why there's a large, sort of like a group of people all across the world advocating for the return to organic, because we are beginning to see the problems and, we're beginning to see the problems coming out, that are popping up left, right, and center all across, the animal kingdom, that can be traced back to inorganic, you know, farming practices.
So, yeah. I mean, we've stolen enough time, Almut.
Yeah.
I don't know how much we can still steal.
We're done. So, time to run away. Until tomorrow, same time, same place, on your favorite radio station, Eagle FM. From me, you all have a blessed evening.
And on my side, dear listeners, let's see each other again, same time, same place. Yeah, we'll be more serious tomorrow.
Nah.
Great news. Imba just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription.
Dear listener, the following show is a playback.
3-month subscription, 10% discount for 6-month subscription, and 25% discount for 12-month subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you.